The afternoon here, so I believe next we were going to move to the cross-examination of Dr. Kennedy. Are you ready?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Matanowski, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Dr. Kennedy. Doctor, you're a PhD, correct?
Yes.
You're not a MD.
PhD.
So you're not a clinical immunologist?
Not a clinical immunologist.
You mentioned you published on measles virus?
Yes.
How many times?
I have one peer-reviewed publication.
And you said you published on MMR?
I stated that in that publication it discusses MMR.
Okay. So the same publication that talks about measles virus is the one that talks about MMR?
Correct.
Have you ever testified in court before?
No, this is my first time.
Well, welcome.
It's loads of fun.
Have you ever participated as an expert witness or a consultant for litigation before?
Yes, I have.
How many times?
Patent, probably three or four over patent issues. From the standpoint of, I'm doing one now relative to an environmental toxin. About less than five, other than patent.
These five, one you said was on an environmental toxin?
Yeah, one involves an environmental toxin and something called acrylamide. Okay. And the other was an HIV needle stick situation. There was the UK report on the measles, mumps, rubella issue. And another one relative to these annuity companies wanting to cash in on AIDS patients' life insurance policies early and to essentially give them a lump sum at a discount to kind of what was the status of their HIV/AIDS infection. So I believe that's it.
That's four.
Four, and this is five.
Okay. You didn't participate in litigation involving a claim that MMR, other than this litigation?
The UK one, I was an expert witness.
Okay, and other than those two, you don't recall any others?
No. I honestly don't like being in court, so try to avoid it.
Well, neither do I. In 1999, you were invited by Representative Dan Burton, to speak at the House, before the House Committee on Government Reform. Do you recall that?
Yes.
And in your report, you mentioned that that particular instance. And you said that when you were preparing for your testimony there, you were surprised to find that there were some contraindications for MMR vaccine.
Yeah. Yes.
And you don't prescribe medications.
No, I don't. But I can read the physician's desk reference.
Right. Now, aren't there contraindications, though, if you read the physician's desk reference to just about every single medication?
From the standpoint of vaccines, I would say it varies on the type of vaccines. That the live attenuated group, of which MMR is has more complications than, let's say, a subunit or recombinant-derived or a glycoconjugate type of vaccine, such as the HIV. And with the HIV vaccines, there are different conjugate forms depending on which carrier protein you use, or whether you use a synthetic oligopolysaccharide. So it's really vaccine dependent.
Okay. If I were to take a look at, say, Tylenol, would I find contraindications to that?
Yes.
You think there may be more for a live vaccine? Is that what you're implying?
I would say a live vaccine has special issues and contraindications that you wouldn't find for other vaccination forms.
Now, you were in front of Representative Burton to talk about hepatitis B vaccine.
Actually, I was there to talk about issues related to safety considerations and informed consent, and essentially educating physicians on what they should tell parents relative to providing vaccines.
For hepatitis B vaccine, right?
For hepatitis B, yes.
Hepatitis B vaccine is not a live vaccine, is it?
No, it's a subunit. Early subunit, later recombinant form.
Now, I know this is 1999 when you were testifying, but in the report you say you professed surprise at these numbers of contraindications. Does that mean up to 1999 you really didn't know much about MMR vaccine?
I would say I knew more about hepatitis B vaccines, and I knew the most about failed HIV vaccines, but certainly I looked at live attenuated approaches as one of the approaches to develop new types of viral vaccines in my laboratory, so I was certainly aware of anything that was a successful vaccine, and certainly anything that was licensed. I believe I used the MMR vaccine in my first medical school lecture in 1989.
In 1999, you didn't know what the contraindications were before you prepared.
I was surprised at the level.
And the contraindications are that you shouldn't give it to someone who has a neomycin sensitivity or allergy?
There's a number, and it depends. It's developed with time. So if you look at the various physicians' desk references, the various volumes over the years, so volume 51 differs from volume 54. So it's developed as things have become clearer.
Is there any contraindication there to administering MMR vaccine in someone who has has autism?
To my knowledge, no.
You mentioned that you thought that everyone should, ideally, and to be fair, you said it wouldn't be practical and the cost-benefit wouldn't justify this, but you thought that everybody should have an immune workup before they got any vaccination.
I think that they should not only have an immune workup, they should be tested prior to and post, because there's issues from the standpoint of transplacental transfer of immunity. So if mother has been exposed and transfers IgG antibodies to the infant, that can affect the vaccine's efficiency, its ability to induce immune response. There are a number of conditions that can be measured prior to decide when is the optimal time to get the vaccine or when the vaccine should not be given.
Has any public body advocated, scientific body advocated such an approach?
Not to my knowledge.
Now, when you were giving your testimony to Congressman Burton, did you state at any time during that testimony that you believed that MMR vaccine was causing problems?
To the best of my recollection, I was there to talk about hepatitis B vaccine, and I talked about, in general terms, vaccines and adverse events and reporting systems and VAERS in very general terms.
And did you mention any problems with MMR vaccine?
At that time, I didn't specifically mention any, to my knowledge, anything relative to MMR or DTaP or any other vaccines. I was more present to discuss the immaturity of the neonatal immune system.
You didn't advocate at that point that there should be a choice with regard to whether to vaccinate with MMR vaccine, is that right?
I'm not a health policy person, so no, I didn't.
But you were advocating that there be a choice for a hepatitis B vaccine.
Hepatitis B is a certain situation. For instance, hepatitis B is transmitted via infected blood products, via sex, and in utero from a chronic carrier mother to its infected infant. I don't know too many newborns are 1 or 2 year olds that are IV drug users, that are sexually promiscuous, or if mother is chronically infected, that you know the physician or pediatrician or OBGYN is not aware of that prior to.
So you were willing to comment on health policy as far as that vaccine?
I believe I didn't comment to those direct terms. That was 1999, but I'd be happy to comment on it now.
I think you just have.
Yep.
Now, measles vaccine, or measles virus, I should say, has never been the focus of your research, has it?
Yeah, actually, it is.
It is the focus of your research?
One aspect of a lot of my research activities.
And you have yet to publish anything on it?
Correct.
Other than your one paper?
The one paper.
Anything in press?
No.
Any studies that, any data has been generated?
Yeah, you? Actually we're trying to develop a specific pathogen-free baboon colony that is free of all pathogens that potentially cause immunosuppression. So what we're doing is trying to select females and males that are characteristically free using qualitative PCR and some serologic diagnosis of a number of infections, and of which we're examining measles virus or measles virus-like entities along with simian virus 40, the retroviruses that are present in human and simian species, herpes B virus, so a number.
You're using measles virus to help develop a certain subspecies or subset of primate for use in research, correct?
Correct.
So the focus of your research is developing that primate, is it not?
Correct. But I use measles virus, among others, to develop that primate model.
And that's your research?
One of them. I do other things.
None of which that have been published?
No, actually I have 8 publications this year.
On measles virus?
Oh, no.
I'm sorry.
Okay. I was talking about the other things.
Okay, so you have other research going on?
Yes.
But that's not involving measles virus?
Correct.
And you don't research, you're not researching mumps or rubella either, correct?
No.
And neither at Texas Tech nor at any of your previous academic positions were you researching measles virus or MMR, correct?
Could you restate the question?
Neither at Texas Tech nor at any of your previous academic positions were you researching measles virus or MMR, and let me qualify that, other than to the extent you've talked about with this study to try to develop the primary.
Research, do you mean physical hands-on, my laboratory is working on it, or research, do you mean that I am competent in reading the literature and being aware of...
I mean research that you're carrying out with your laboratory.
Okay.
As part of your academic research.
No.
You mentioned that you've been... this is just a point of clarification. You mentioned that you've been working with HIV... virus, what turned out to be HIV, an unidentified virus at the time. And I don't take this question the wrong way. I just want to make sure that this is clarified. You weren't suggesting that you had discovered HIV.
Oh, no, not at all.
I want to make sure I understand your theory of causation here. Can you please state it as simply as possible, step by step, what your theory of causation is?
With regards to?
Why are you here to testify in the sense? How do you think the MMR vaccine led to Michelle Cedillo having an autistic spectrum disorder?
Well, if you look at my slide 20 and 21, I think it's pretty clear there. If we could have that. So my last two slides. I didn't get a chance to memorize my slides in my lectures. I don't have a copy.
So I guess I could start by saying, does this encapsulate your theory?
Yes. Do you need me to read it again?
No, I don't need you to read it. I need to go through it to make sure that I understand.
Okay. When I'm not sure what the question was, when you he said this, are you referring to...
I'm not sure.
The summary of the expert report,
yes.
When you answered yes,
yes.
You're talking about the entire summary of expert report, which goes from 16 through 21, or...
No, I would just say the summary, which are the last two pages, 20 and 21, relative to the last question.
20 and 21, okay. Go ahead, Mr. Magnus.
Thank you. This would be Petitioner's Trial Exhibit number 8, I believe, and we're on page 20.
Yeah.
And you have that before you, don't you, Doctor?
Yes.
Now, it starts off and it says the detection of MV measles virus, RNA from several measles virus structural gene products, and I won't go further. Where is the immunosuppression? How does immunosuppression play a role in this? Because I heard a lot of testimony about immunosuppression.
I gave essentially basic aspects related to immune dysfunction, immune dysregulation, and immune deficiency. And one of the contraindications for MMR is an individual that is immunosuppressed. So I really didn't discuss aspects relative to immunosuppression. I think it's best addressed by the clinical immunologist. But certainly I provided aspects that this is how immunosuppression, immunodysfunction, immune dysregulation can occur. What are the environmental triggers? What are factors? And what is the difference between a congenital or primary versus a secondary or acquired?
Do you need, in your hypothesis, do you need immune suppression?
I would say it definitely would help.
So,
yes.
You do need it. Is that a yes, you do need it, or you, in some circumstances you don't need immune suppression?
I would say that immune suppression is one of the environmental requirements are factors that are necessary to allow persistence of the virus, and the virus must persist for this scenario to occur.
So in the absence of immune suppression, then your postulate or your hypothesis, you wouldn't hold to that?
I would say it's less likely, yes.
Then are you still saying it's going to happen?
Have you ever heard a scientist say anything is 100% certain?
I'm not asking for 100%.
Okay.
I just want to make sure I understand your theory, that's all. So, do you need immune suppression in your theory to be of the opinion that more likely than not,
yes,
that MMR vaccine caused ASD?
That measles virus persisted and this caused problems associated with ASD, yes.
What level of immune suppression do we need?
I don't think, from my assessment, I think that's probably best left for a clinical immunologist.
what kind of immune, there are different, I understand from your testimony, there are different kinds of immune suppression. What kind of immune suppression do we need?
I would say that anything that would affect the induction of an effective vaccine MMR-induced protective immune response.
Okay, let's break that down. What would prevent an effective vaccine immune response?
It could be holes in the innate immune system. It could be holes in the adaptive, the humoral immune response. It could be holes in the cell-mediated immune response. It could be holes from a standpoint of the induction of any of the products necessary. It could be a skewing of the response that would not provide normal protective immunity. It could be the lack of production. It could be the overproduction.
So any of them may play a role. If any of them are present, would you find that it's more likely than not?
Yes.
Okay, so it doesn't matter which one of them.
No.
And you don't need more than one. You can have any of them.
You can have any of them, or you can have several.
What if you have some of them working and others not? Does that make it less likely that there's immune suppression that would lead to viral persistence?
No, that's why the term immune dysfunction or dysregulation, meaning not everything is operating properly.
Okay, so just any at all?
Yes, but there are probably specific ones that one would anticipate based on the biology of the measles virus that might be occurring.
Okay, and this is in somebody who does not mount, as I understand it, your testimony is about somebody who does not mount an effective response to the vaccine.
Correct.
How do you measure an effective response to the vaccine?
There are a number of serologic, virologic, and immunologic assays that can be used.
Okay. Want to name those assays?
Viral neutralization assay.
Any others?
Indirectly, a cytotoxic T cell assay measuring the ability to lyse infected targets with an MHC class 1 matched target.
Any others?
Indirectly, an ELISA specifically for the neutralizing epitopes found on the H gene product.
Any others?
There's more complex ones. There's T cell assays based on flow cytometry. The induction of proliferative responses specific to a protective epitope that is MHC class 1 matched to one of the measles virus proteins that are components thereof. These tend to be very specialized assays, not routinely used.
What's the one that we most commonly use to test whether there's a vaccine, if there's been an effective immune response to a vaccine?
We really don't measure that. What we tend to measure is an ELISA, where you use the whole virus components and you're measuring the antibody response to it.
Antibody
response. But we don't know if those antibodies are protective or not.
And that would be a sign that there's been an effective immune response to the vaccine?
No, that there would be a sign that there is an immune response to the vaccine.
Ah. Okay. Now, why is it that you believe that there's immunosuppression when someone is introduced to MMR? MMR is introduced to someone?
There is citations from the literature. There is a number of citations that deal with measles virus being immunosuppressive. I pretty well think that if it occurs in medical and graduate student textbooks, that it's immunosuppressive, that it's pretty much considered dogma by the majority of people learned in the art and field.
You heard my questions about measles vaccine virus, right? I think I said vaccine virus, but I'll clarify. What support is there that measles vaccine virus causes immunosuppression?
There's some publications in the literature.
Could you name the most recent?
No, because I stuck with textbooks and older ones, but I can certainly name one that I cite in my report.
And what one is that?
Fireman 1969, I believe. But I'd have to get a copy of my report to verify that.
Was that MMR?
I would have to get a copy of my report to it. If you could bear with me. In 1969, it would be very difficult for it to be measles, MMR vaccine, wouldn't it? So that would be measles virus, the fire number.
Measles vaccine virus, right? Is that what it's about?
The measles virus.
Oh, measles virus itself?
Yes. Yeah, a 1969 publication would be most likely not here with MMR or immunosuppressive. Would you agree?
That my question was to you, and I thought it was a little surprising when you...
Measles virus. I stand corrected.
Any other literature support for the notion that measles vaccine virus causes immunosuppression?
Yeah, I would go ahead and cite the chapter from the Watkin and Mortimer vaccine, 1994, the chapter on measles, MMR vaccine. Do I know the most recent? No.
Anything else that you can think of today?
That would be it right now.
Do either of those references tell us what level of immunosuppression there would be after measles vaccine virus?
No, they really don't. This is with the vaccine. They really don't discuss what levels.
Do either of them say whether those levels of immune suppression are clinically relevant? And do you know what I mean by that term?
No.
Okay. Do they have any meaning for the host, for the body that receives them, of any significance?
I would counter that any level of immunosuppression has some clinical relevance. Has the clinical relevance for that been defined? I'd say no.
Does the immunosuppression that you say, or in these references, do they indicate that the body or the host that receives the vaccine is unable to mount a response to the vaccine virus itself?
In some of the instances, it is not clear what sort of vaccine-induced responses were generated.
I don't think I followed your response.
So in other words, the studies were not done in a careful manner to address those questions. So in other words, they looked at total ELISA, but they didn't look at responses to specific epitopes. They didn't measure T-cell responses from a specific measles virus recall response. They looked at things like general overall immune function.
And what did they find when they looked at general overall immune function?
Any
problems with clearing measles virus from the vaccine?
They did not specifically examine to see if the measles virus persisted anywhere. What they did was they correlated the presence of an immune response with that being an effective immune response and therefore getting rid of the measles virus. And as far as the normal situation in a healthy host, the measles virus is clear.
So these two references don't support the notion that immunosuppression plays a role in persistent measles virus infection in the body?
These references actually state that immunosuppression as the result of exposure can result in a persistent infection.
A persistent measles virus infection from the vaccination.
Okay, you're tripping me up.
So, no, I'm not trying to.
Okay, so measles vaccine, so from the MMR, does it persist as the result of immunosuppression that's examined? That really has not been addressed or looked at.
So they don't support that notion?
They don't support that because the technology at that time point of that reference I gave you was not there to be able to look at.
Is that what they said?
No, that's what I said.
You see, because it seems that important to your theory is that it not just immunosuppress, but that it immunosuppress in such a way that the vaccine virus continues to persist, correct?
But I'm not saying that it's necessary for the vaccine to cause the suppression. I'm saying anything can cause the suppression, any environmental trigger. And if you go back to the material I presented, I mentioned that measles virus is an environmental factor that can cause immunosuppression. My premise does not deal with MMR being responsible for immunosuppression. My premise deals with any environmental trigger that can result in immunosuppression, can set up the potential for an ineffective immune response that then leads to persistence.
So the MMR vaccine itself is not at all, at least the immunosuppression involved in it is not integral to your theory?
No. But if it happens, it helps.
But we don't have support that it happens.
We have support in that chapter that says that, that it...
And that, it causes, that it allows the vaccine virus to persist?
That it can cause immunosuppression.
Of any clinical relevance to the vaccine virus?
Of clinical relevance to the vaccine virus? So do you mean is it clinically relevant to...
To the persistence of vaccine virus.
That is not stated in there.
All right, just for the record, before we leave this topic, the two references that Dr. Kennedy cited, the Fireman article and the excerpt from the Plotkin text, they're both cited at page 10 of Dr. Kennedy's report, and the articles actually are in the record at Exhibit 112, tabs D and N. Go ahead, Mr. Matanowski.
Thank you. I have some further questions on the vaccine virus. Now, the MMR contains an attenuated measles vaccine?
Yes.
Attenuated measles vaccine virus, right? And you mentioned briefly what was meant by attenuated. Could you explain to me what the process is involved to attenuate that virus?
So essentially, they take what was a wild-type measles virus and passage it multiple times in host-cell tissue culture that allows it to replicate, and the more that you allow it to replicate, it becomes less virulent, less pathogenic, and attenuated. It doesn't replicate as strongly.
What kind of host cell passage? What kind of host cell do they use?
They usually use some sort of monkey kidney fibroblast as standard. Hopefully not contaminated with other viruses like SPV.
You said it doesn't replicate as well?
Right.
So if I'm understanding that part of your testimony, I'll take a step here. It wouldn't replicate as well as the wild virus?
Right, as a wild type.
So it wouldn't proliferate as readily in the body?
It should not, no.
Turning back to your theory, after this immunosuppression and there's an introduction of the virus, what happens next?
as far as
your theory.
This case?
You've gotten the vaccine. What happens next?
Virus persists.
How does it persist?
It's not killed by the normal host immune response. And innate and adaptive immune responses come into play. They're not effective at resolving the infection, but they can be effective at causing other problems, affecting bystander cells, causing inflammation, causing tissue destruction, causing tissue damage, causing inflammation. So standard things for an innate and adaptive immune response.
And this will happen in anybody who has any kind of immune dysregulation because you had a whole broad array.
Right. Individuals that have no functioning immune system, it would be lethal. And those that have a pretty good functioning immune system, it may not be as severe.
If we were to take, I don't know, we got about 50 people total in this courtroom, I'd say a rough guess, and we were to perform an immune test on them now, take all these functions that you were talking about, do you have an estimate about how many would have some abnormality and some immune function?
I would kind of need to know other factors like how much alcohol they had last night, what their liver functions were. So for me to make a real good guess, I need some other information.
So any of these could affect
you? Any environmental trigger? Yeah.
And I understand, and they could affect.
Did they eat a heavy meal? Can I get the lymphocytes necessary to do the assay? I mean, there's a lot of confounding factors. If you're asking a statistically general question, in an adult population that has an income over $75,000 a year and has good hygienic scenarios and live past the age of 35, I would say that you probably wouldn't find anybody who exhibited immunodysfunction.
Any they wouldn't have any IgG2 elevation amongst these 50 people?
Well, you're looking in general in kids at, 1 in 500. So
1 in 500 for what?
For any sort of evident immunodeficiency.
By all the tests that you were talking about, it would be 1 in 500.
About 1 in 500 for congenital. The answer
because
is
you said any environmental.
I was referring to congenital.
Okay.
From a standpoint of the secondary or acquired, it's really not known.
Is it fairly common or is it fairly rare?
It really hasn't been looked at in a lot of detail from the standpoint of a large population. I don't know how many people in here are HIV infected. If they're HIV infected, there's a good chance that they're have some sort of immune dysfunction. I don't know if people have hepatitis C. And so these are confounding factors.
I just want to know, is that the level of immune dysfunction you're talking about to be significant for
No, it could be anything. I thought I gave the example of Pneumovax, where just a slight alteration affects the ability to resolve an infection.
Amongst these 50 people, do you think that maybe... I can tell you, in terms of all of my paralegals are below the 75,000 range in their...
You guys are underpaid.
But
I would demand more.
Now, amongst these people, do you think every single one of them is going to have every single panel absolutely normal?
No, there's going to be variation. There's going to be some that are high and some that are low. But will they fall in a median, plus or minus a standard error? I'd need a biostatistician for that, but I would say... there's a good chance that they would. They'd fall into some sort of normal range.
Now, we give MMR to, I guess we vaccinate just about over 90% of our children. Do you think every single one, except for the autistic spectrum disorder, the kids who eventually have that autistic spectrum disorder, develop that, whether or not they're MMR, have normal, every single immune panel is normal when they get that MMR vaccine?
No. If you're asking me neonates versus adults, that's a different question.
Mm-hmm. unfortunately, I'm moving rapidly through my questions here, Doctor, so this pause is a good, it's good news for
time,
you.
Yeah.
It's good news for you. Now, in your report, you mentioned thimerosal as part of your thesis of immunosuppression. I didn't see that in your conclusion, your summary here, and I didn't hear it in your testimony this morning. Is thimerosal part of your theory?
I just mentioned mercury as being an agent that is responsible for immunosuppression. I mentioned heavy metal exposure, so mercury.
And is it necessary to have exposure to thimerosal, in your view, to have this immunosuppression that, or immunodysregulation that could cause a persistent measles virus infection?
I would say that anything that would be an environmental trigger that could cause immunosuppression would be a reasonable part of the immune dysfunction that's necessary for my... actually, it's not really my hypothesis, it's more my... plausible explanation on the events that occurred.
What do you mean it's not your hypothesis?
Well, so as a scientist, my hypothesis would be stated differently. So it's not a hypothesis. A hypothesis is developed before you want to address a question. I had the information, and from that information came up with a plausible scientific explanation.
Okay,
I wouldn't call that a hypothesis.
So you were actually working from a result and working back to how that result could happen.
Correct.
So the result was autistic spectrum disorder after exposure to measles, mumps, rubella vaccine.
No, the was measles virus in the gut at a time frame when I wouldn't anticipate that it would be there if the child mounted an effective immune response to the MMR vaccine.
And resultant autistic spectrum disorder.
And that subsequently, based on what measles virus and morbillivirus viruses can do, could lead to neurologic manifestations.
So you reasoned back from those facts to an explanation that you think is plausible.
Correct. I didn't have an overriding hypothesis when I looked at this.
On the thimerosal, do you need that as far as your explanation? Is thimerosal necessary?
No, but it is helpful. I mean, anything that is an environmental trigger that causes...
So we could take out, in this instance, we could take the thimerosal-containing vaccine and assume that Michelle Cedillo never got it, and your conclusion would be the same.
Mercury and thimerosal is not my area of expertise. So the only thing I know is from the textbooks that heavy metals cause immunosuppression. And apparently thimerosal is composed of mercury. So as far as relying on what she got at what time point and how that affects, that's not my area of expertise. I would leave that to other experts.
Okay, so you have no idea what level of immunosuppression you could expect after exposure to thimerosal?
No, I don't. But I know the level that you can expect on general exposure to heavy metals.
You said in your report a potent immunosuppressive. Was it potent in this case?
Potent immunosuppressive from the standpoint of this child? I think I just used it in a general context of mercury, thimerosal containing mercury, in general heavy metals are potent immunosuppressants.
Yeah.
I don't think I used it specifically to say for this particular individual.
At what level, in your view, would it be, what level of exposure to thimerosal would it be would be necessary for it to be a potent immunosuppressant?
Well, as I've stated, I'm not an expert in inorganic chemistry or in heavy metals per se. The information that I obtained to state that heavy metals are a potent immunosuppressant are textbooks and general knowledge of the field that these do cause immunosuppression. To point out that this is another environmental factor, a trigger that could cause it.
So, I don't want to belabor the point. So, I can take it then that what you did is you read some textbooks in preparing your report.
Actually, I took my lecture notes from medical school and graduate school and read some additional textbooks and made some slides from it.
So, in preparing your report and preparing your slides, you took some notes that you had taken back at when you were in medical school.
Well, no, I wasn't in medical school. No, I teach medical students.
So, in terms of your statement, I was just dealing with your statement on potent immunosuppressant. That's taken from some textbook references?
Yeah, and general knowledge that heavy metal exposure is a potent immunosuppressant. Much like chemotherapy is a potent immunosuppressant. Much like steroids to prevent transplant rejection are potent.
Steroids are potent immunosuppressant? I'm sorry, did you say
steroids? No, I didn't say steroids. I said immunosuppressive agents used to prevent transplant.
I see.
Costocorticoids, sorry.
Now, I want to make sure I'm clear. You don't feel that you have expertise, though, in the area of heavy metals, is that right?
From the standpoint of how they function and work, no.
As an immunologist, do you feel like you have expertise to address how they work on the immune system?
A little bit.
Okay. Can you answer then how much, from that standpoint, how much would be necessary to produce a potent, how much exposure to thimerosal would be necessary to produce a potent immunosuppression?
From a body standpoint, I couldn't. From a test tube standpoint, I could.
And from a test tube standpoint, could you tell us now?
Yeah, you can get down in nanomolar ranges in test tube to exposure to cause an aberration of an immunologic function assay.
What nanomolar range?
In the low nanomolar range, like 10 to 100 range.
Per what?
Some nanomolar is a volume. So nanogram
exposed,
is nanomolar.
Expressed as what?
As the amount added to the culture. So nanomolar is nanogram per measure of volume.
Okay. So exposed to culture.
Exposed to culture.
And what's this based on?
Publications in the literature that show specific dendritic cell dysfunction.
Can you tell me right now what those are?
No, I'd have to refer to notes that I didn't bring with me, or a literature search that I performed, or I'm sure you could ask the clinical immunologist who would be more in tune to looking at this. This is just based on studies that we've done from immunosuppressive agents in general in the laboratory.
You've done these studies?
I've done certain ones, not with mercury, but with other heavy metals.
Okay, and these are published somewhere?
No.
Why were you doing these studies?
We were actually looking at proteins on HIV that were immunosuppressive, which we did publish on. We didn't include those heavy metal controls because we were interested in what were the proteins of HIV that were causing immunosuppression.
What and heavy metals? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So we were using essentially lead because that was extremely toxic to the culture, and we had to have some sort of control as a baseline to show that everything was dysfunctional, everything was potent. So we used that as a control. But we never described that in the publication because our interest was looking at HIV. And these were in culture, so in testing culture.
Any other heavy metals that you were using in this experiment?
Now, lead was the easiest one that we could get, and we just threw it in there as a control.
And you knew that this was going to be toxic?
Yeah. At levels that we were also measuring our HIV proteins at. And we found a wide disarray of dysfunction, including affecting NK cells, lymphocyte-activated killer cells, general immunosuppression. So, and I have published those. If you go to my CV in 1987, 1988. Although if you ask me the details, my memory's not.
Do you have any idea how long the immunosuppression would last after thimerosal?
In a person who was exposed, it would depend on the amount, how often they got it, additive effects, age.
Can you give me a number of factors?
Body fat. Well, the answer is no, not without those factors. And I wouldn't be the one to calculate that. I would ask an expert in that area to calculate that. But there are a number of factors that determine.
So it's dependent on a number of variables?
Yes.
And you're not competent to, in your area of expertise, to comment on
this? No.
Now, it's important to your theory that measles virus RNA be detected in the host that is supposed to be harboring the persistent measles virus?
Yes.
Where do you need to find that measles virus RNA for the purposes of your explanation?
I would say PCR is a good start.
Not how, where?
Where?
What part of the body?
I would say in this particular instance that we're focusing on, I think a gut sample, gut tissue, gut biopsy from the area of where the inflammation was noticed. So at the site.
Why the gut?
Because that's where the problems were caused, that's where they did the biopsy, and that's where they found it, and that's where I would not expect it to be found.
Why wouldn't you sample material from the brain?
For ethical reasons. It's pretty tough to do a brain biopsy.
I understand that. But if you were looking
if you do it on dogs, you can find it in canine distemper. So.
If your theory is that the virus is causing autism, where would you expect the virus to persist to cause a problem?
I think the fact that it persists and causes inflammation in a specific area, and that the immune response is a global systemic issue, that problems in one area can manifest themselves as problems in other areas.
So, if you have, in your theory then, if you have a problem in your gut, you're going to have a problem in your brain as well?
You could, yes, because these are neurotrophic viruses.
Yes, but that means that they're in the brain.
That's what neurotropism, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So you need the virus to be in the brain to cause the problem.
I didn't say that. I said they're neurotrophic viruses. I'm saying if...
I'm trying to understand your theory. So if it's just in the gut, and I'm trying to figure out how now that's going to be affecting... giving a problem that's going to affect one.
So inflammation, the inflammatory response, can be local, but can also be systemic. The immune response can be local, but it also is systemic. If you didn't get a systemic immune response, then you wouldn't be able to clear the MMR vaccine, because it's found in multiple places as it goes through the process of inducing an effective immune response.
So, just to understand, so in your construct, we just have the persistence in the gut, but it creates an immune effect that is felt throughout the body.
That's one possibility.
Is this your explanation, then?
No.
What's your explanation?
So my explanation is that if it's found in an unlikely place, such as the gut, there's evidence that suggests that it can be found other places, like the CSF and the brain, and then that can cause more neurologic manifestations than one may see just as a result of the systemic immune response gone haywire.
So in other words, really your explanation is that it's not just in the gut, but it's at least throughout the body to your brain.
What I'm saying is this virus and group of viruses has the capability of doing that.
And do you think that that's what's more likely than not happening as far as your explanation?
Without having the information and data on Michelle, from a standpoint of the presence or absence, I can't say that specifically, but I know of instances where that can occur, and that can result in neurologic disorders.
Now, we'll turn to those instances, and I'm still trying to figure out, make sure that I understand your theory. Is your theory overall that the virus has disseminated through the body? Is that what you think is happening more likely than not after this immune suppression or immune dysfunction that permits the virus to persist?
That's a plausible explanation, but not an absolute explanation.
Is that your explanation?
My explanation would be dependent on what information was available. The information I have available suggests that it's a plausible explanation.
So, if I take that away, if I tell you that it's only in the gut and it's nowhere else in the body, do you still feel that it's more likely than not that the persistent measles virus is causing autistic spectrum disorder?
I would say yes.
And what's the basis for that opinion?
The immune response and the systemic inflammatory response. I'm saying it's a possibility. Is it the most likely possibility? No. Is it more likely than not? Yes.
So for you, just recovery from... If I could show you that it wasn't in the brain, it wouldn't change your opinion if you could recover measles virus from the gut.
I would say that there's a possibility that set up the overall systemic response that caused...
More likely than not, would you say that it caused the autistic spectrum disorder if I told you that I could not recover measles virus from the, or I had no evidence that it was in the brain?
More likely than not, I would say yes, but if you gave me measles virus in the brain, then I'd say, guess what, I'm right.
So you still would say, even if there was no evidence it was in the brain, you'd say it's more likely than not.
There's a lot of things that can go on, from the presence of having foreign viral RNA, activation of toll-like receptors. There's all sorts of inflammatory conditions and cytokines that can be secreted that cause systemic issues, just from the standpoint of having the presence of foreign RNA, viral RNA.
And doesn't that happen in numerous occasions?
But in normal people, it's not an issue. In people that have a skewing immune dysfunction, then it can become an issue.
Do we have any examples of viral persistence of measles virus other than when you've recovered it from the gut biopsy tissue? Are you aware of any?
Are there other
examples? Now, let's say you don't have any recovery of measles virus from gut biopsy tissue. So are there other examples of persistence of measles virus?
Yes.
And there are other, you were talking about the other mobiloviruses. There are examples of persistence in those instances?
Yes.
In those instances, turning to the mobiloviruses, What's the outcome when the virus persists?
Usually, from the standpoint of a dog, it's has a temper problem, issues, it's deranged, and it's usually put to sleep.
And if it weren't put to sleep, what would happen?
Probably those neurologic manifestations would result in death.
And in the other instances, the virus, the phocine?
That was found in seals that had died.
And in the Morbilla virus that was affecting dolphins, what happened?
Again, found in dolphins that died. But again, you usually don't do autopsies on live animals. So if they're floating around in the ocean, it's kind of hard to know what the level of infection is. There are examples of North Sea seals that recovered from exposure to Morbilla viruses.
And is it persisting when they've recovered from it?
They actually resolve the infection.
So when they resolve the infection, there's not a problem?
I'm not a behaviorist from the standpoint of what the long-term effects would be on dolphins and other animals like that, but I can imagine that in some instances there may not be issues, and others there may be issues. I mean, the brain is a very touchy thing.
What do you know about measles virus, what it does on a cellular level?
Quite a bit. It activates some immune responses, activates T cells. The studies that have been done that really well characterize measles virus have been done in experimental animal model systems, such as mice. And when they've set up the infection in mice to examine what is required for protective immunity, they've been injecting measles virus at doses that cause CNS disease, and they eventually have to euthanize the animal, and they use some sort of scale on when to euthanize the animal because the legs are dragging or some other issue. But certainly it's shown clearly that some mediated immune responses to measles virus are important for protective immunity.
How long will it take for this persistent measles virus to begin damaging the brain?
I don't know. In a human? In a mouse, I know.
I'm sorry?
In a mouse, I know. I don't know in a human. Ten days is standard in a mouse, depending on the route. You can get it faster if you want to give a higher dose.
And how long before the mouse has to be sacrificed because of the level of neurologic damage?
Actually, it's really dependent on the institution, what is required by their institutional animal care and utilization committee for pain and suffering of animals. So it's pretty much dependent. Some people can
What's
give...
What's the longest amount of time?
Probably, depending, if you give a low dose and you want it to persist, you can bring it out to 40 days. If you want to give a high dose and want it to, you know, just manifest quickly with CNS disease, 10 days.
Ultimately, the course for those mice would be death soon after.
Yes.
Whether you
convulsions, death, yeah.
Whether you sacrifice them or not.
Whether you euthanize them or not, yeah.
And you can't tell me how long the process would be of neurotropism in a human.
I can't.
You still have your expert report in front of you? Not your expert report, your slide presentation.
Yeah. Sure.
If you turn to page 15 of that, talking about PCR and recovery of measles virus. When we're doing the PCR, what part are we amplifying here? The red, the blue, the green?
The blue.
And that's the blue at the top line.
Yeah.
Would be number right with the red at number one.
Yeah.
And you said that was positive.
Positive strain.
In your view, as an immunologist, is a single test enough to determine whether or not there's been an immune dysregulation?
Yes.
And just, in your view, just having the IgG2 is enough for immune dysregulation?
Well, I think
that'll permit persistent virus?
Not only the IgG2, but the fact that it still persists tells me that whatever immune response was made wasn't effective.
Okay, if I take away the evidence that there's still persistence, if I were to take that away and you just had the IgG2, would you think that there's still persistent measles virus?
If you took away the persistence, no, then there wouldn't be persistent.
If I took away the recovery of measles virus genomic material,
I would have to know if that IgG1 and IgG2 are viral neutralizing. If they were viral neutralizing, then I would say there's not a problem.
So if you just have this, you said the IgG2 level was off in this case.
Was elevated.
Was elevated, okay. If you didn't have recovery of measles virus genomic material, if that was called into question, would you still be of the opinion that there's persistent measles virus?
So if you don't have measles virus RNA there, and you have no evidence of measles virus being there, but you have an elevated IgG2A response, which I'm not even sure is specific toward measles virus, would I still think that's persistent?
That's right.
No. If you don't have measles virus RNA there, why would you anticipate that it has anything to do with measles virus?
So you really do need recovery of measles virus RNA?
Yes.
In the one article that you published in 2004 on MMR vaccines, that was your first article on MMR and annual measles virus, right?
Correct.
At the time you published that, you were a consultant in the UK litigation, MMR litigation, is that right?
No, that was over with.
Okay, so you had been a consultant before then?
Correct.
Was the litigation over with, or was your involvement with it over with?
My involvement was over, and I think, I don't remember the time frame, but I think the litigation was over with. I'd have to refresh my memory.
When did your involvement end?
When I filed my expert report.
When was that?
Again, I'd have to look, but I would say the time frame would be 2002, 2003.
took parts of that report that you published and used it in your expert report in this case. Is that right?
I used information that I obtained to do my expert report to provide certain aspects from my input and also from the other co-authors, their input to provide that article, yes.
I'm not talking about I'm talking about the expert report. You took parts of your article in 2004 and placed them into the expert report that you filed in this case, correct?
The article in 2004 was actually published after the expert report.
I'm sorry. I can see the confusion. Not your expert report in the UK litigation. Your expert report here in this case.
Actually, to be honest with you, I couldn't find any reprints of that paper because my secretary had moved my office, so I had to go without having access to that paper to do this. So
you didn't take parts of your 2004 paper and use them in this report?
I didn't have access to it because the reprints that I had were in a file somewhere, but I had excerpts that I used to essentially develop. So to answer, did I use that manuscript, the published paper, word for word? I used excerpts that I had, which were probably from the formulating the opinion, our opinions, our information for those. For instance, a section on Mobile virus.
You used those word for word, right?
I would have to look to see if I used it word for word. Hopefully I would have changed it a little bit, but I think the premise would be identical, that they're neurotropic.
In your paper in 2004, you had parts in there that you didn't use in your report here.
Right.
Actually, I guess we can show you, if you'd like, side by side, word for word, where parts of your paper are repeated in the report here.
Is that illegal? I mean, it's my reports.
No, it's not illegal, sir. Actually, it's the next point that I want to make that this becomes important for, because it's the parts of your paper that you left out that I think we want to focus on now. That you left out of this report. In your paper, you acknowledge that based on your review of published research.
Would you give him a copy?
Yeah, do you have a copy? So, I don't have a copy. And how long was the paper? How many pages was the paper?
Is it, Mr. Manasky, is this paper in the record?
I believe it was submitted.
It's cited in my expert report. I don't know.
It would have been a petition exhibit.
Right.
We're going to pull it up on the screen so that you can take a look at it there. In your paper, you acknowledged, based on your review of the published research, population-based studies had not been able to detect a link between MMR vaccination and autistic spectrum disorder. Is that right?
Correct.
And that didn't find its way into your report here.
Was it relevant to my report? I don't believe my report says anything about autism, does it?
That's the issue that we have to decide here.
Well, I'm the immunologist and the virologist, so I focused on the immunology and the virology. So. And I agree to that statement. That statement supported by the literature and by the IOM NAS report. So I agree with that statement.
So do you hold an opinion as to whether or not MMR vaccine is causing autism?
Yes, I have an opinion.
Is it?
I don't know. Is it plausible? Yes.
Is it more
is
likely?
Is it absolutely? No.
Is it more likely than not causing autism?
It would have to be examined on an individual-to-individual instance. If that makes sense.
So you believe it is?
I believe it might and can under the appropriate conditions. Do I believe it is in all instances? Absolutely not.
You didn't say no. You believe that it is?
On an individual to individual situation, I would, that it could.
Okay, so that it could. Is it more likely than not doing it?
Yes. In an individual situation. Do I say MMR causes autism? Absolutely not. Can it in an individual that has the following considerations? Persistent measles virus infection present in the gut? Yes, it could.
So in your opinion, is MMR responsible for an epidemic of autism?
No.
In your opinion, is it responsible for 5,000 cases of autism?
I'm not an epidemiologist, so I can't.
In your opinion, would it be then you only could tell on a case-by-case basis?
I would say that you would need to look at instances on a case-by-case basis.
Would it be rare?
You know, I'm not really an expert in neurology or autism, so I don't know what you mean by rare.
Well, you're offering an opinion that on a case-by-case basis it can.
Yeah.
How often will we see
it? It would depend on the conditions of that case. You'd have to find measles virus.
You'd have to find
they would it. Have to have an immune response to the measles virus, and that immune response didn't clear it.
Okay. So you would have to find the measles virus.
You'd have to have a set of characteristics and criteria that I would need to state that, yes, it's possible for, in this situation, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine to cause neurologic disorders.
In your view, would one of those criteria that have to be fulfilled, recovery of measles virus genomic material from the individual?
I would say.
I think Dr. Kennedy's answered this question several times in different manners, reformulating the question, and then asking the question reformulated again. It's been asked and answered.
Well, I'm not confident that that's the case, so I'll let them go on.
So yes, you need to find measles virus. RNA is a good start.
Is it necessary to do that, in your opinion, to reach the conclusion that MMR caused autistic spectrum disorder?
In my opinion, from the standpoint of measles virus vaccine being directly involved, yes. Indirectly, I can't say that.
I'm not sure I understand you, sir.
So all the other circumstances that we talked about, the presence of immune dysfunction, the presence of nonspecific inflammation, I'd have to look and see how did the individual respond to the vaccine, how much other factors were involved. So you're asking me to give a global statement that I can't give. The best I can say is on an individual basis that direct evidence is the best.
It's just an easy question. Do you need it or do you not need it?
You need it for direct evidence. Is it possible that it could occur in another manner, indirectly, through inflammation, etc.? Yes, it's also possible that way.
How does the inflammation occur without persistent mucus plugs?
Through a number of mechanisms.
And this would not be related to MMR then, without persistent measles virus.
Persistent measles virus is one form that can cause inflammation. MMR that doesn't persist when it was resolved could have set up an inflammation, could have set up a fever, could have set up an issue, been resolved late, if no longer persistent, but it set up a scenario that allowed the immune system to get haywire. So that's another possibility. Less likely, but it's still a possibility. Indirect cause.
Is it more likely than not?
I would say it's less likely. Is that so? The opposite of what you're saying.
So it's not more likely.
It's not more likely. The indirect would
below,
be...
It falls below the 50% threshold.
Correct. But it's still possible.
So in your view, MMR, it's possible that MMR can cause autistic spectrum disorders even if the virus doesn't persist.
In some circumstances, it's possible. But again, it's the it's not the most likely, then it's the low side.
It's below 50%.
Yes.
Now, turning back to your paper, you said in your review that large gaps remain in our understanding of the risk factors and etiologic mechanisms of ASD. Isn't that right?
Correct.
Now, where were you reading from?
This is page 132
of the paper.
The 2004 paper.
Okay.
These are all series of questions that I'll be asking about parts of the paper that didn't make it their way into the expert report in this case.
Okay.
Could you identify that by exhibit number for us, Mr. Matnowski?
Certainly. The exhibit number for the report. I'm sorry, we thought that this had been filed, but apparently it's not been filed by the petitioner. This report will file as a trial exhibit. I apologize.
All right.
We'd assume that a
I
report
just
by the expert.
I lost something from my computer
okay.
here.
All right. No wonder we couldn't find it. All right.
I apologize. Right.
That's okay. Why don't you file it as, I think it's the respondent's trial exhibit 3.
We'll do so, sir.
Okay.
Yes, I agree with that statement.
And you also stated in your report that investigators have also failed to demonstrate causality between MMR vaccination and autism.
Yes.
You agree with that statement?
Absolutely.
You stated in your report that, quote, conflicting data exist regarding the studies reported by Wakefield and colleagues, end quote, who purported to find persistent measles virus in the intestines.
Straight from the published literature.
And so you agree with that statement?
Absolutely.
And you wrote, quote, there is little evidence to support persistent infection by the vaccine strain of measles virus except for individuals with a compromised immune system who are immune dysfunctional, end quote. And you agree with that?
Yes.
You also wrote, the biological model linking MMR and autistic spectrum disorders remains incomplete, correct?
Correct.
And
we don't have any good animal models that would allow us to approach these issues in a direct manner.
You agree with that, and you agree with that statement?
Oh, absolutely.
And you still agree with that statement?
Yes. You guys didn't find my typing errors in there? Hey, getting back to Lubbock by airlines is not easy, so I've got plenty of time.
In your 2004 report, you stated you would need, quote, to find, quote, detection and isolation of the vaccine strain of measles virus in the gut of afflicted children, end quote, to be persuasive evidence of a biologic model linking MMR to ASD.
That was in reference to trying to develop an animal model that would closely mimic the human scenario. And also it was related to Koch's postulates.
In your view today, is that what's necessary to find persuasive evidence of a biologic model linking MMR to ASD?
For something to say that this is a relevant model of the human situation and disease, yes. Without having that animal model, without being able to show that, then you have some issues.
So other animal models
just don't do it.
And other models, that we don't have other models.
We, you know, canine distemper, I don't know too many dog psychologists that figured out if they've got canine distemper, they're autistic dogs or not. So that's why I kind of stick with neurologic manifestations, if it affects the brain and cause a number of manifestations.
You referenced in your opinion in this case personal communications between you and Dr. O'Leary.
Yes.
Were those the, was that the meeting that you discussed earlier in your testimony?
Yes. In fact, can I take this time to clarify? I called Dr. Shields the pathologist. She's actually not the pathologist, it's Dr. O'Leary. He's the pathologist.
Okay.
You said that that meeting took place in 2002 in the United Kingdom?
Yeah, to the best of my memory, early 2002, could be late 2001. Trying to remember my transition from Oklahoma to Texas Tech. It was in that time frame.
Where in the United Kingdom did that meeting take place?
It was in London.
Do you recall when in 2002, 2001 that would have been?
I'd have to look back at my travel. I was doing a lot of travel in transition, so I can look back and report back to you on the specific dates. I tried to jog my memory, and I've been away from Lubbock for about 2.5 weeks now, so I haven't had a chance to go back and look and check to see specifically. But it was in 2001, fall 2001, spring 2002, somewhere in that time frame.
Did you meet with them as part of the UK litigation?
Actually, I was invited over there by a colleague to just evaluate the data. And as a result of my evaluation and criticism of the data presented by Dr. Shields, the UK litigators decided that they liked a guy from Texas who wore a Texas shirt and wore cowboy boots, and they asked me at that time, would I be interested in.
So the litigators were at this meeting?
The litigators did not attend the meeting. They were not at that particular meeting. But after the meeting, that's when we had conversations.
Did they set the meeting up?
To my knowledge, yes. But they did not offer the invitation.
They set the meeting up, but the invitation was offered through an intermediary.
Right.
And who was that intermediary?
John Marchionis. He's a professor and chair at microbiology and immunology at the University of Arizona.
He was working with the litigators.
Okay. Yes, I found out later on, yes. But then so didn't I. So.
When you were meeting with Dr. O'Leary, did he discuss with you any criticisms of the Unigenetics lab?
Actually, Dr. O'Leary was not physically present at the meeting. It was Dr. Shields who was presenting the data, and Dr. O'Leary was available later on for teleconference. So she presented the data in a scientific format, and over 4.5 to 5 hours, she was asked a number of questions relative to the technology, the standard operating procedures, the immunohistochemistry that was shown, how she detected, what were primers, what were the sensitivity, how was isolation done, what were controls, what were positive controls, how did she know that this was not contamination, what were the samples. She was essentially taken apart by, I would say, 3 to 4 extremely good molecular biologists.
Yourself included?
No, I took her apart, not that I'm an extremely good molecular biologist, just from a standpoint of, you know, I wanted to know, you know, is this real or not?
And Dr. Shields, she is a colleague of Dr. O'Leary?
Yes.
And she worked in the Unigenetics lab at Coombs Hospital?
Yes. I never understood the connection between Trinity, because she was also at Trinity, they were both at Trinity, and Unigenetics till later on.
And what was the connection?
So my understanding was Unigenetics was set up as a for-profit laboratory to do testing for measles virus specifically for this situation to alleviate any legalities and issues and problems that may occur with Trinity College.
This situation being litigation, correct?
No, just from a standpoint of universities don't like to be involved with biotech companies or whatever, other than to own a little stock on the side. So they like to set up foundations. That's how they do it in the States. So if they're a state institution, you set up a foundation so you don't break state guidelines from the standpoint of ownership and things related to that. So I thought it was kind of a standard situation that Trinity College, being an old college in the UK, this was the way that they were going to set up. Instead of setting up a foundation to do it first, they just set up a separate laboratory.
So is it your understanding then that Trinity College set up Unigenetics, or did Dr.
O'Leary set it up?
Because it was a for-profit.
Because it was a for-profit, and that is a non-for-profit entity.
So he wasn't doing it for the university.
He was. So I guess the best way to say it, this is a common practice that universities and institutions keep productive investigators around. So what they do is they allow them to be entrepreneurial, to set up startup biotech companies, to have ownership in that. The university also figures out to have ownership by setting up a foundation. It's not really a university-sponsored company, but the university is aware of it.
Did the university have any stake in Unigenetics?
I'm not aware of that. I'm not aware how Unigenetics was set up. whether it was a chapter, and I don't know how they set up corporations. I don't know if it was a chapter S or an LLP or.
So when you were at this meeting, you were provided with protocols, test results, all the information regarding how Unigenetics was operating and what their results were that were coming out of that lab.
Correct.
Did they discuss with you at this the equipment used in the lab?
Yes.
Did they discuss with you how the lab was laid out?
Yes.
Did they describe how the samples were prepared?
Yes.
Did they describe the primers that they used?
Yes.
And their specificity?
Yes.
Can you think of any information regarding how they were conducting their testing that they left out of that, at that meeting, that they left out of their presentation at that meeting?
We didn't have, there was one individual at the meeting who had visited the Unigenetics laboratory, but we didn't see, for instance, a visual on the layout. We had a description of isolation was done in this laboratory, the PCR was done in this laboratory, our reverse transcriptase was bought from here, here's how we bought the isolation kits for the RNA, here's how we prepared the samples. So they actually had standard operating procedures, a list for a lot of the things that they were doing, because I think the anticipation was that this was going to be a long-term testing scenario.
Was there any information that you felt was lacking that you would need to understand whether or not their test results were reliable?
Actually, a number of us asked for a lot of things that weren't presented initially, because they're standard stuff. Why aren't they in there? And they were provided to us.
They were provided to us.
Not necessarily during the initial presentation, but we were able to see a number of things that were concerned about primer specificity, about things like cross-contamination, about things like isolation, how you dealt with the tissues, the difference, the dyes used, the machine, the reproducibility of the machine, the standard curves used. So we got a lot of information that is not necessarily available through the Ullman paper.
Were you satisfied you had everything you needed to determine whether or not it was reliable?
We still had scientific discussions from a standpoint of, in some of the assessments relative to, a lot of us felt very uncomfortable from a standpoint that what they were doing was essentially using cycle number to determine a positive versus a negative reaction. We were happy with, they were doing quadruplicate samples, so that was not an issue. But we had a problem is that they were pushing the sensitivity of this to the very low end. And they were using cycle number, which was not really a standard at the time, which was not used at the time, to determine a positive versus negative. And some of the samples that were on the verge of the limit of sensitivity, there was a large amount of argument over whether these were truly positive or truly negative. And a number of suggestions were made on how to improve that from a statistical standpoint.
Who else was at the meeting?
There was Dr. Richard Tedder from the UK. He's a professor of clinical virology. There were no lectures. There were no lecturers present, so it was all pretty many people. There was a program chief from the National Institutes of Health, National Institutes of Neurologic Disorders and Stroke, Dr. Stephen Jacobson, myself, Dr. Marcia Lonis, Dr. Shields. There was a pediatrician molecular biologist whose name escapes me right now, who was real sharp. Come up with that name later, and one or two others. It was a fairly small intense session.
How much do you know about PCR?
We do it in my laboratory.
Do you know enough about it to answer some questions?
As an expert? Well, it depends how technical you get.
Because you were offering an opinion earlier about the validity of the Unigenetics lab result via Ullman.
About the Ullman?
The Ullman paper?
No, my opinion is based on the fact that it was detected. I relied an opinion on the O'Leary and Shields lab based on the information that I obtained at this, and also through PubMed searches to see that they are being productive in 2006 and 2007 with 12 joint co-author papers in some excellent high-impact peer-reviewed journals such as Cancer Research, Journal of Molecular Pathology, etc. So the laboratory is doing their thing.
So I'll launch into some questions then about PCR. Before you conduct an experiment doing PCR, do you develop a standard operating procedure?
Yes.
Would you follow that standard operating procedure throughout the experiment?
If we're going to do a large amount of samples, we have to set up the conditions first. When we set up the conditions, that then allows us to determine what our standard operating procedure is.
If you're going to operate the lab as a diagnostic, essentially a diagnostic lab, would you need a standard operating
procedure? Absolutely.
Would you vary from that standard operating procedure if you were doing it diagnostically?
No, and if you did, there would be adequate notes taken as to why it occurred, why it happened, and what was the issue.
Would it make a difference to you in terms of the reliability of a result that came out using a RT-PCR if the quality of the probe varied from batch to batch?
Absolutely.
And would you think the reliability of the results were less if the probe varied from batch to batch?
So the question was, if the probe was messed up...
If the probe, the quality of the probe varied from batch to batch, would you expect the results to be less reliable?
So your question is, if the probe is a problem, do you expect more variability?
Yeah. My question is,
I'm confused. So.
It's actually a lot simpler. Would you call into question the reliability of a PCR test result if the probe quality varied from batch to batch?
So if you ran out of probe during testing, then, and you substituted new probe from another place without going back and setting up your standard conditions, would I question that? Absolutely.
Now, if you had the same, if you were using the probe and from batch to batch, the quality of your probe varied.
The same probe?
Yes, the probe.
The only reason it would vary if you had to have new probes synthesized.
Okay.
So that would mean you ran out, so you have to reset your conditions, have to order more. So yes, that you don't do that. without resetting your conditions and...
Would the reliability of the PCR result, would your assessment of the reliability of the PCR result be less if the amplification efficiency varied from batch to batch?
So batch to batch, what are you talking about? Your TAC polymerase? What is the batch to batch variation?
If you run one batch and you have a certain amplification efficiency, and then you run another batch and your amplification efficiency is different, does that call into question the reliability of the results overall?
Are you running a standard curve at the same time, and do you have proper internal controls and have you standardized?
So
that
these
batch
are the
curve?
Things that you would need to know.
Right.
And could you go through, please, all the things that you would want to know in order to assess whether it was reliable?
I'd want to know how it was run. All samples should be run at the same time with a positive and a negative control. It has to have a standard curve in there. It has to have a number of internal controls. You know, when I publish my PCR technology, I do, in peer-reviewed publications, I don't write down all this stuff that's necessary for.
So what is
that
it that you would need...
That people learned in the art normally include because it's a given.
If there was amplification variability, what is it that you would want to look at?
I'd say the TAC polymerase is bad. I'd want to look at a new TAC polymerase. Could be primers bad. It could be a number of different things.
And these are all things that would go to the reliability of the result you would get.
Correct.
Would you want standardization, that you'd use the same amount, extract the same amount of RNA each time for testing?
It depends. So a number of us use different techniques for quantitation. Some of us use a standard housekeeping gene. So
I'm talking about the amount that you extract for testing.
So you mean the size of the tissue or the
amount of RNA that you're testing?
It depends what you're trying to set up.
If there's variability from time to time, now you're using the procedure diagnostically, and you vary the amount of RNA that you're extracting for testing.
So you're varying the amount that you add to each of the well?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
That's how you generate the standard curve, okay? And that's how you also can quantitate, because you have to hit the linear portion of the standard curve to be able to tell how much is there. And that's a standard procedure. So to get the absolute quantitation, you need to do five different amounts.
If you vary from your SOP and the amount that you extract, your SOP is set up to tell you how much to extract, and you vary from that. Does that call into question the result that you receive?
So the initial amount you extracted is different, or the initial amount you added is different?
Never mind. It's fine, sir. Would you want to see that the test results for negative tests consistently came back negative?
Better, yeah.
And if they didn't? Would that call into question the result?
I would say that absolutely, and you need to run them again, and you need to find out why that negative result became positive. Part of the aspect of the troubleshooting, which is with the very sensitive assays, is something that's routinely done.
What's the gold standard PCR testing?
As far as quantitative PCR,
What would be, in terms of the accuracy of, let's make it specific to this case. You're trying to identify measles virus RNA. What would be the best possible way of doing that? PCR standpoint.
So you'd have quantitative PCR and you'd use multiple primer pairs.
That you believe is the best way to do that.
Or PCR.
You wouldn't sequence?
Oh, you're asking after you detect it. You're saying for PCR in general?
Yes.
All right. Once you've got a positive, yes, you want to sequence. In fact, Dr. Shields was asked, had they sequenced and verified that this was indeed vaccine strain? And they had done sequencing of H and F.
Specific to vaccine strain?
Specific, their allelic discriminator from the F, they had actually sequenced the product that came out.
Specific to vaccine strain.
Specific to vaccine strain.
And they didn't publish this.
This was in, I had assumed that the Ullman paper had already been submitted. So,
and the Ullman paper
came
was
out
criticized.
2002.
And they had this data. And it was never published.
I think it was criticized after the fact that it was accepted for publication, that it was published. So it went through peer review. Those criticisms were not levied. The criticisms came afterwards, after the paper was published, that you should have done this, you should have done this. And now I think if you take a look at anyone that was doing PCR at that time, that you knew that you needed a sequence to verify it, but did you always do it? Yeah, if the paper you submitted it to and those reviewers came back and said you need to sequence it, you did one of two things. You sequenced it to get published, or you submitted it to another journal and saw what the issues were then.
Okay, so you could get it published without sequencing by just going to another journal.
That's correct.
And after
depending on the reviewers.
You have to sort of shop the paper around to find somebody who didn't require sequencing.
Actually, it's more the luck of the draw. You get a reviewer who's out of town, who's in a hurry, and is not, as stringent as he might be. Or you get someone who, is not familiar with certain aspects and
doesn't know to ask.
Correct.
And in the 5 years since you saw this data, none of this has been published?
To my knowledge, no.
Dr. O'Leary's been involved in this?
Yes. Okay.
Does Dr. O'Leary believe that the data generated by his lab supports a causal association between MMR vaccine and autism?
He never made that statement, to my knowledge.
So he presumably has this data that you've seen, this data that no one else has seen, and yet he doesn't believe.
Well, the point is, it wasn't in every individual.
Which would mean that there could be a problem with the data, correct?
No, it means that their positives were positives and their negatives were negative. And not everybody was positive. And there were negatives, so not everybody had the same.
So he didn't believe
situation.
There was enough there, though, to conclude that MMR
is a cause.
Is causing autism.
I would say that anybody that would say that, based on any sort of data, it would be very problematic in most scientific opinions and assessments.
I'm talking about Dr. O'Leary.
Oh, Dr. O'Leary. I can't speak for him, but no, he never made that statement, and.
And he has this data.
He has the data.
And he's the one that you said is, I believe in the report, is well-regarded and well-renowned.
Yes, and he's also a pathologist by training. So he did a lot of the immunohistochemistry to prove that there was a N protein product present in these autistic enterocolitis children.
you were asked a question. You've given some testimony. You were asked a question by one of the special masters, I believe it was Special Master Campbell Smith, to clarify your statement on. She asked you a question about your statement on high copy number and what the significance of that was. Could you clarify what the significance of high copy number in the measles virus RNA, what the significance is?
Essentially, to me, it suggests that the amount that's there is high compared to what you would anticipate with a natural measles virus infection. And if it's high and if it's there, then it had to amplify in some manner. And the only way that it could amplify would be to have it transcribed into the positive strand and have some evidence of replication. Does that make sense? Sorry.
Maybe it does to the special master, but it doesn't to me. I'm sorry. I'm trying to figure out how you have higher copy numbers than you have in natural infection.
So what happens is when you usually look at copy numbers for natural infection, you've got an effective immune response that is trying to clear things. Okay? And as it clears things, the amount goes down. It's a natural process. So the immune system is supposed to get rid of this. As it gets rid of this, the number, copy number, would go down. As you resolve the infection and there's no more measles virus there, then the copy number should be undetectable or zero. In this situation, to get a higher copy number, I would state that in light there's an IgG antibody response, that is not effective at clearing, resolving the infection. So you're getting an amplification of the measles virus RNA to higher copy numbers than you would anticipate just through a natural infection, because it's amplifying and replicating. So the measles virus enzyme is making more.
What if it was higher than in the peak times of an infection? If the copy numbers here are higher than in the peak times of an infection?
I would anticipate that you've got a lot of inflammation in your arm.
If the copy numbers here exceed what you see at the peak of a natural infection, why would that be?
Because you're pulling the copy numbers from a biopsy material where inflammation is ongoing, and that high copy number, as the result of amplification, is probably resulting in that inflammation. When you look for copy numbers in a natural measles virus infection, you are not going to a specific site where it's inflamed. The individual will actually eventually resolve it.
So it's your belief that there's more measles virus there? Is that what you're saying?
There's more measles RNA.
Okay. And not necessarily more virus? Is that what you're saying?
There's virus there because there's protein there. So the process is going on, but I can't argue that there's more measles virus there. There could be. There might not be.
Are these copy numbers in any way related to the amount of measles virus that are there?
Now, as I mentioned before, it's not a one-to-one situation where you get one message producing one protein, producing one virus particle. It's more stoichiometric than that. And you can get, RNA without getting the protein. So the RNA can accumulate and not necessarily get protein.
Okay, so there's just this RNA, but without actually virus.
We know, at least in the autistic enterocolitis kids, that there is nucleoprotein by immunohistochemistry. So there's protein. Did they isolate virus?
I'm just trying to figure out how we get these
high copy number. So I would simply say, I would say that it's evidence that there's amplification in the infected cells that produces more RNA.
Amplification of RNA?
Amplification of the virus. Negative strand to the positive strand.
In your report, in this case, you mentioned that you had been a reviewer for the IOM when they reported for the Immunization Safety Review Committee on MMR vaccine and on thimerosal-containing vaccines.
Yeah.
What were your conclusions to them? What did you tell them about the issue?
That essentially more studies needed to be done. My conclusions were not that different from theirs. But bottom line was, if this is such an important issue, we need to be putting more money into it from a federal government standpoint to resolve this issue. And it needs to be a multi-front scenario. The limitations of what the report found from a standpoint of being able to say it causes or it doesn't cause, those limitations need to be examined from an experimental standpoint and need to be supported through funding agencies like the National Institutes of Health, because it's an important issue and it needs to be resolved, including things like developing animal models, looking at sensitivity issues from the standpoint of, are there more and better assays that can be brought to bear, which are presently being used in cancer treatment, cancer diagnosis, which are very sensitive and work very well. Can we bring those expensive assays into the arena and address this issue?
Did you tell them that you believe that MMR vaccine and thimerosal-containing vaccines acting together caused autism?
Not to my knowledge.
Did you tell them that thimerosal vaccines caused immunosuppression in the vaccine recipient?
I was not at that level of critique. So what I was essentially a reporter in there. And I essentially evaluated what was going on and gave my opinion of where things need to go.
Did you agree with their conclusions?
Yes, except for one.
What conclusion was that?
The conclusion was that they didn't specifically come up with a recommendation for the National Institutes of Health to examine this as a priority issue.
So you agreed with their conclusions favoring the rejection of a link between MMR vaccine and autism?
They rejected the causal, but they didn't reject the possibility, if I'm correct.
And you agreed with their conclusions, but just you thought that there should be more research done. Is that
absolutely
right?
And yeah, let's address the question.
I have no further questions at this time.
All right, let me. Will there be any redirect?
Yes, Special Master, but could we take a
break? I was going to say, if there's going to be redirect, let's take a break. Take a 15-minute break. All right.